So, I always find it interesting which chapter we're on and what is happening in my life and in the world when that chapter just comes up to talk about. So this chapter is chapter 31, called Self-Compassion and Compassionate Self-Correction. So this is one of Russell's chapters. So it's going to be written from a more psychological viewpoint, but also a very Buddhist viewpoint. And I was thinking, you know, that, yeah, the world's been pretty full of turmoil between the pandemic and George Floyd and calling out racism and police brutality, and then the danger to our democracy with the threat of putting the military in cities. And so it's like, oh, a chapter on self-compassion. That's just what I need. You know, it's like, this world's too much. So I'm going to have self-compassion. Relax, be peaceful. Forget about the rest of the world. But self-compassion doesn't mean we forget about the rest of the world. Yeah. And that's the trick. Sometimes self-compassion, I don't know about you, but when I hear about it, I think, okay, I'll just forget about everything else. Oh, I'll be peaceful and compassionate myself. Rejuvenate myself, and then I'll go out and face the world again when I feel like it. And in really thinking about it, self-compassion and compassion for others should not be two different things. Yeah, we shouldn't separate out caring for ourselves and caring for others and thinking that to have self-compassion, I tune out the rest of the world and just take care of myself. And then I go out to have compassion for others, and I'm the warrior, and I drain all my energy out so that I'm exhausted at the end, and then I can come back and have self-compassion in my nice little comfy, cozy, womb-like thing. So there's got to be some way that we see these two together and that we don't separate them out and we don't, make our life kind of schismatic with a time for one and a time for the other, okay? But to bring them together and... Because if we have compassion for ourselves, then we realize that everybody else is in the same predicament as we are. And so if we're going to have compassion for one person, we better have compassion for everybody because we're all in the same boat. And we can't really separate ourselves out. You know, we live in this interdependent world. And whether we know other people or not, the more we know ourselves, the more we can understand how other people are. We can never exactly know their experiences, but we can certainly understand a lot about them by understanding ourselves so that if we have compassion for ourselves, then we have compassion for others. And similarly, you know, when we see the pain in others, that pain or exists in us too. Whether we're feeling it right now, the potential for that depth of pain exists in us. It's not others' pain out there, and I'm sitting here protected from it. Yeah. Again, we're all in the same boat. We're all sentient beings. We all have the 84,000 afflictions. Yeah. So I was watching the protest in D.C. yesterday, And at one point, there was one mother who got up, because we're only hearing about some of the young Black men who've been murdered by police. There's a lot more that we aren't hearing about. So this was a mother of one of them, and she was leading the protest at that moment. And she was asking everybody to say the name of her son, which was Marcus Brown. I had never heard of Marcus Brown before, but when that mother was passionately talking about her son and then broke down in tears, it's like, I felt that here. I'm not a mother, at least not this life. You know, I can't say I understand what a mother feels. I can't say I understand. I've had the same experience as what a Black mother feels, or what a mother feels whose child has been murdered by police. But I can know pain, and I can know the pain of injustice. Yeah. And, you know, she and I were not two separate things at that particular moment. Okay? So it's the same way. If we can put ourselves in other people's shoes, yeah, then we get in touch with our levels of our self that we might not know that we have. And also, the more we get in touch with levels of ourself, the more we can understand what other people's experience is. Okay? So even though I'm going to be reading this chapter on self-compassion, don't think it's just compassion for me and I can block out the rest of the world. Yeah, we can't do that. Okay. So, we've mentioned that while compassion is often thought of in relation to others, it can also be directed towards the self. Since our goal is to direct love and compassion to all beings, we need to recognize that we are included in this. Yeah, whenever we talk about all, it includes us. Yeah, sometimes we think, oh, all sentient beings, you know, have Buddha nature, but not me. You know, we need to stop thinking of ourselves as being so special and unique. Yeah? Okay, so we need to recognize that we are included in all and direct these positive emotions to ourselves as well. While we're no more deserving of compassion than other beings, we're certainly no less deserving either. A compassionate perspective is based on the fundamental assumption that all beings are worthy of compassion and kindness. Okay? So we're no more deserving, we're no less deserving. Okay? So this pride, you know, the pride that thinks I'm the only one, or the pride, you know, and I'm the pride that thinks I'm so good, and the pride that thinks, oh, I'm worthless, I can't do anything right. You know, they're very much the same because they both make a big deal out of the self. And that's something that we're really trying to get over in our Buddhist practice. So the more we are self-compassionate and willing to address the sources of our own suffering, the better prepared we'll be to direct compassion towards others. Self-compassion helps us work with obstacles in our own mind that can get in the way of our compassion for others, such as disturbing emotions and troublesome habits. If we're truly going to be effective in manifesting compassion for others, we have to have some for ourselves as well. So very often, you know, we will get stuck in some kind of psychological something, you know, we lacked something when we were growing up, or we experienced something that nobody else did when we were growing up. And so there's some kind of need inside of us. There's some kind of, a need or a wish or a desire, and or some kind of resentment and pushing away and fear. Yeah, that's kind of unique to our own experience because of certain experiences we've had in this life, or maybe because of karma we brought in from previous life, experiences that we had or actions we did in previous life. But those kinds of things can, when we get stuck in certain emotions inside of ourselves, it really inhibits our ability to open up and have compassion for others, because we're like a, we're like a desert that needs water, and we're just so stuck in being this desert with our own psychological needs that we can't see that everybody else is also a desert. Yeah. And so self-compassion can be very helpful in the sense of us learning how to fulfill our own psychological needs. Instead of grasping outward, I need somebody to tell me I'm wonderful. I need somebody to love me. I need respect. I need appreciation. I need. And putting it all in the hands of the world to give it to me, which when is the world ever going to do that? Yeah? So to pull ourselves out of that state of mind and learn to meet our own needs. Yeah? And so I think that's very much what self-compassion is about. And when we can learn to meet our own needs, then we can free ourselves of being so needy like that. Okay? I don't know if this is making any sense. You know, years ago, if somebody had told me this, I would have gone, no, because I was so needy in myself, I couldn't even think of meeting my own needs, you know? But it was later when I started to really practice the Dharma and switch my mind, you know, and really start to analyze what I considered to be my needs that other people had to provide for me and that I had no power over. It was only when I began to really do some research in that area that, I began to be able to shed some of those things, either because I realized that they were too exaggerated, or because I began to see that actually I have that ability in myself. I don't need to rely on other people to give that to me. And if I don't feel I have that ability in myself right now, it is an ability I can cultivate. Yeah? So just to give you an example, I remember my late teens, early 20s, I was such a mess. Okay, I remember, because this was the days of the encounter groups and the... you remember encounter groups? And do you remember the things where you went and you threw pillows and you screamed and you cried and then everybody hugged you? Do you remember that? Yeah. So some of you are too young. Maybe you didn't have that. But, you know, some of us, this is... our late teens, early 20s, what happened, okay? So I remember being in one of these groups and just because I was trying to become an adult and I couldn't communicate with my parents really well because we had different ideas about many things. And I just wanted my parents to love me for who I was and not because I was their child and not because I was going to perform and become this excellent student and get, and, you know, marry the right person and give them grandchildren, plus be rich and get, you know, the fantastic job and all this. I just wanted to be loved for who I was. So I remember, you know, it was my turn in the group and like saying this to everybody. And then I was like sobbing, I want my parents to love me. I'm sobbing, nobody loves me. Yeah? And this was really serious business. I was in so much pain, you know? I mean, incredible pain and crying, and they all hugged me, and I still am in pain. And okay, so this is before I met the Dharma. And then I met the Dharma, yeah, and the Dharma gave me a way to understand myself and to become my own friend and to see that my craving for other people's love was a craving that could never, ever be fulfilled. Yeah, it was something unrealistic because everybody else saying they loved me didn't fill up the hole inside myself of my not being my own friend and my not accepting myself for the way I was, warts and all, okay? And so the Dharma gave me a way to kind of understand this and, you know, in the process of cultivating compassion for others, it also came back to me. Yeah. So that's just an example, you know, to show you that it can be done. And to look at how excruciating that pain was 40 years ago, and now I'm laughing about it, and I can make you all laugh about it. But at the time, it was overwhelming. Okay, now what does that tell you about our psychological states? Number one, they are impermanent. Yeah. Number two, they are not consistent. You can feel one thing at one time and another thing at another time. So don't lock yourself into some self-image that you think you always are because you aren't. Yeah. So it's quite, yeah, interesting. Okay, enough self-confession. Okay, we're on the third paragraph. This is a long chapter. I better keep going. Western psychologists have given specific attention to self-compassion because of how pervasive shame and self-criticism are in the West, particularly in people entering psychotherapy. People suffering from crippling levels of depression and anxiety often have very powerful internal self-critics. Anybody here have a powerful internal self-critic? Yeah? Oh, you don't? You have one of the biggest ones. The self-critic, this, I'm not good enough. Everybody's better than me. Everybody else got Buddha nature. I don't have it. I'm damaged goods. I'm full of shame. I wasn't treated properly. I don't have compassion. I don't have wisdom. I can't become a Buddha. I. Okay. So that's that powerful internal self-critic. They spend a lot of time attacking themselves with their thoughts. I'm disgusting. I'm unworthy of love. I'm hopeless. I can't do anything right. Anybody else have those thoughts? Yeah. It's like this is a pervasive illness. Yeah. These folks say cruel things to themselves that they would never say to other people and can find it extremely difficult to relate to themselves in warm and compassionate ways. While we may not all have this level of self-loathing, many of us can be surprisingly resistant to the idea of letting go of our self-criticism and replacing it with a warm, compassionate internal voice. I was remember one time somebody came to do a program here, very remarkable young man, very high achiever, okay? And then when his internal self-critic came out, we were talking about it, and I said, you know, what keeps you clinging to this when look at what you've achieved in your life? And he said, I'm afraid that if I give it up, I won't have any motivation to improve myself. It's only my self-critic that pushes me to improve myself. And I said, that's not true. It's not only your self-critic that can push you to improve yourself. In fact, it's your self-critic that keeps you from improving yourself. You know, you've got to give yourself some credit for what you've done and have some acceptance of what you haven't been able to do and have some compassion that you aren't the best one in the world and that doesn't matter. Because no one is the best one in the world. Okay? So don't beat yourself for not being the best one, because that is a status that no one can ever have. He was really shocked. It was such an internal habit of his, you know? So to learn to think about himself in another way was really a big thing. Yeah. We may think that without the constant torrent of self-criticism, we'll be self-indulgent, failing to hold ourselves accountable for our behavior and not trying to improve ourselves. So we become attached to this state of mind that is actually self-sabotaging our growth. Yeah, by thinking that this state of mind is actually helping our growth. It's not. My self-criticism isn't very effective in helping us take responsibility for our lives and improve ourselves. Compassion is. But that's the thing. We're so afraid. If I'm compassionate, then I will be self-indulgent. I'll just sit there and say, oh, poor me. I haven't been loved enough. Poor me. And we're so afraid that self-compassion will validate all of our pity parties. Okay. If we think like that, we're not understanding what self-compassion is. Okay. Pity parties go in the same category as the same kind of self-loathing stuff that we're used to giving ourselves, because it's all overemphasis on the I, and emphasis on the I that is unrealistic. Okay. So don't think self-compassion justifies your pity parties. It doesn't. Yeah. No, but I want some justification for my pity parties. because I feel so lousy when I have them. Huh? Okay. So self-compassion isn't about talking to ourselves in a sweet voice that endorses whatever it is we feel like doing in the moment. Yeah, I remember once talking about, compassion at a talk, and somebody raised their hand afterwards and said, I feel like my whole life I've been compassionate, and now I'm going to go take care of myself, and I'm going to go to the shopping center and buy what I want. And that's what she thought was self-compassion. It's not. Okay. Rather, our compassionate internal voice helps us take responsibility for our behavior and coaches us to improve, but does so in a warm, encouraging manner that recognizes the suffering and challenges we face. Okay, so we're not flipping and then going to criticize ourselves for, you know, look at you, you have so much self-pity, you know. So we're not flipping it in that way. It's a warm, encouraging voice, but it takes responsibility for what we're feeling. And it's a confident voice because we know we can change. We're not giving up on ourselves. In short, self-compassion resembles compassion for others, but it involves the ways we relate to ourselves and the emotional tone we take in doing so. So there's some compassion there, yeah? So sometimes we may see that we're getting into some really self-destructive thing of criticizing ourselves, yeah? And it's very good at that time, either self-destructive criticism or being that needy, dry desert, okay? And it's very interesting in those times to step back and talk to yourself and say, or talk to those states of mind, rather, and say, what is it I'm really trying to say? What is it those states of mind are really trying to say? When I'm sitting there, you know, being, nobody loves me, I'm incompetent, what am I really trying to say? Yeah? What is that mind really trying to say? It's really trying to say, I need to see my own potential. I need to accept myself for where I am. I need to give myself credit. Okay. Yeah. That mind isn't really, the mind ostensibly is saying, I need other people's love and affirmation. But really, what I'm needing is to be my own friend. Yeah. When I'm in those states where I'm just like ripping myself to shreds with all my faults and all my, I can't do this. And you're such a failure. What is that state of mind really trying to say? Yeah. What is it really saying? It's saying, I need to pay some attention to myself in a realistic manner. That's what it's trying to say. It's not trying to say, you're hopeless, give up yourself. That's ostensibly what it's saying. But it's really saying, I need to pay some attention to myself in a realistic manner. Yeah? And all this self-blaming is not very realistic. So again, what is realistic? I have the Buddha potential. I have some talents. I don't have other talents. I have some talents, but other people are better than me. That's okay. That's perfectly okay that other people are better than me. Yeah. My purpose in life is not to compete with others. My purpose in life is to develop my own potential and to become a compassionate, wise person. And to do that, I don't need to compare myself with anybody else. And I don't need to meet anybody else's standards. And I don't even need to meet my own standards if I give up comparing myself to others. Yeah. What I do need to do is acknowledge my potential and act on it. Yeah. So it's very interesting, you know, these different states of mind, to really ask yourself, what is it that these states of mind are really underneath it trying to say? Yeah. And sometimes they're saying, I need to cut myself some slack and say, yeah, I can do this and I can't do that, and that's okay. And I can improve in the future. And there's some things that I'll probably never be very good with, and that's okay. Yeah. You ask me to handle the water system like Venerable Tarpa is doing it? Really, you know, I mean, I have some potential, but I think that one, maybe if I worked really hard, really, really hard, I could do. But there's other things that maybe it's better I put my energy into, because she undoubtedly is much better than I am in that regard. Thank goodness she is. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any water at the Abbey. Yeah? Okay. So whatever it is, just, you know, some kind of self-acceptance in the process. Okay. Some may fear that developing self-compassion will make them self-centered. We don't need to worry about that, says Russell. He's a psychologist, so he knows. Self-compassion is linked to how we deal with challenges and relate to our own failings and imperfections with acceptance and warmth rather than harsh self-shaming. So we may think other people are shaming us, but how much of that is us shaming ourselves? I mean, all those people maybe that shamed us when we were kids, they aren't sitting there saying that stuff to us right now. Who's saying that stuff to us right now? We're saying it to ourselves. So sometimes we have to tell ourselves to shut up. Because what we're saying is not true. In this light, developing compassion for ourselves may help reduce our tendency to be self-centered by helping us overcome the shame, overcome the obsessive self-criticism and self-hatred that keep us trapped in an endless cycle of self-evaluation. It should say incorrect self-evaluation. Okay. One research study comparing self-compassion and self-esteem found that self-compassion was more strongly related to happiness than was self-esteem. Now that's interesting. What's the difference? Yeah. Self-esteem and self-compassion. Self-esteem is kind of, oh, I've accomplished this. Self-compassion is, I'm good enough the way I am. Yeah. These researchers also found that if the influence of self-compassion was removed, self-esteem no longer predicted happiness at all. That's interesting. In contrast, when the effects of self-esteem were removed, self-compassion was still connected to happiness. Relating to our struggles with warmth and understanding seems even more powerfully related to our emotional health than does positive self-regard. Because I think sometimes self-esteem and self-regard, it's because we've internalized others' expectations of ourselves. Yeah, without them really being in our heart what we want to be. It's important to have confidence in our own strengths and successes, but this study suggests it may be even more important to refrain from kicking ourselves when we're down. Psychologist Kirsten Neff conceptualizes self-compassion as involving three components. One is kindness. So relating to the self with kindness and understanding rather than with harsh self-criticism or judgment. Yeah, I know you tried to do that, and it was a little bit beyond what you're capable of, or I know you tried to do that and you're capable of it, but not all the conditions were there for you to be able to do it. Yeah, makes sense. Drop it. Okay. Then second, common humanity. Viewing our experiences, particularly the challenges and struggles, as part of the common human experience, rather than as separating and isolating us. So I'm the only person who has experienced this. Well, actually, you know, everybody has, in one way or another. Okay. Now, somebody could look at this and say, well, you know, you have the opportunity to have this kind of self-compassion because you have white privilege. Yeah, you don't know what it's like to be an oppressed minority and go through that. You don't have the time and space in your life. You know, you have the time and space in your life to do that internal work. We're just trying to stay alive. So somebody could say that, yeah? Now it's true, yeah? But Native Americans could say that. Yeah, Latinos can say that. Jews can say that. LGBT, I can't remember all the initials, TQ, everybody can say that, you know? So maybe we don't have exactly the same way, yeah. But we have some ability to feel what it feels like to not be accepted by society. Women can certainly feel that way, yeah? So, you know, I think we can open it up to realizing that many things are common shared experiences, even though the exact context they appear in are not exactly the same. Yeah. And especially when you consider that we've had multiple lives. Yeah. And that we bring things with us from previous lives. Yeah. And that in samsara, we've been there, done that for everything. Yeah. If we can open our minds to that fact, then maybe we can see that, yeah, we've all had very similar experiences, maybe not exactly the same in this life. Yeah. But we can still draw on our experiences and our compassion, you know, and our own internal struggles to feel something of what other people must feel. Okay? Yeah. Now, some people may disagree with me about this, but for me personally, thinking about past and future lives, thinking that who we are at this particular moment is not all we ever have been or all we ever will be, that helps me a great deal in broadening my mind to be open to other people's experiences and to stop clinging so much to my own experiences. So both things. Okay. You can criticize me in the comment box, because I'm sure some people won't agree with me. Okay. The third component, Kirsten Neff says, for self-compassion is mindfulness. So holding painful thoughts and difficult emotions in kind, non-judgmental awarenesses rather than identifying with them. Okay. Now, what's interesting, going back to this, okay, I could really identify with that Black mother, this, you know, hearing her talk about her dead son and wanting everybody to say their names. It's much harder for me to identify with the white supremacists who carried their AR-15s in front of the Michigan Capitol. Yeah? That state of mind that they have is much harder for me to identify with. Yeah? So it's interesting, you know? I mean, they're white, but it's like that attitude of, I'm here with my gun and you ain't taking me away because, you know, I got my gun and I got my rights. That, you know, is harder for me to understand. And that's an area where I need to open my heart to having compassion for people who are suffering because they feel so threatened that they deal with their feelings of being threatened by being aggressive, you know? And it challenges me to not be intimidated by these people, but to see that what they're actually saying is, I'm afraid. I want to be happy, and I feel that my status is being threatened, and I don't know who I am. Yeah, and I don't know how to feel good about myself, except to carry this weapon. Yeah. And it's so interesting to me that people think that a weapon is going to prevent them from dying. Once we're born, we're all going towards death, towards aging, sickness, and death. I don't care how many weapons you have, you can't fight death. So why does carrying a weapon make you feel powerful? Yeah. That is so interesting to me, yeah, to think about that and what's going on in a mind that, you know, what is really going on, not what the ostensive superficial display is, but what's really underneath that. In somebody who feels good about themselves, by feeling that they can intimidate others. Whether they're intimidating wisdom or minority groups or whatever it is. What is that state of mind like? Because those people need a lot of compassion. Yeah, they need a lot of compassion. And I need to stop being intimidated by them and learn how to see through the screen they're putting up and have compassion for what's really going on inside their minds and what they're really crying out for. Yeah. And I need to be able to go and talk to them without criticizing their political beliefs and without, you know, being criticizing them. I need to be able to go to talk to them with compassion. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Like Buddhist mind training practices, Neff's approach to self-compassion emphasizes reducing certain habits and cultivating others. Specifically, we want to decrease tendencies to self-criticize, to feel isolated when we observe ourselves struggling or suffering, and to identify with negative emotions as mirrored in statements such as, "I am afraid," which reflect the tendency to accept this emotional state as who I am in the moment. That's one sentence with a lot in it. Let me read it again. Specifically, we want to decrease tendencies to self-criticize. Okay. Decrease tendencies to feel isolated when we observe ourselves struggling or suffering. I'm all alone. Nobody understands me. To decrease tendencies to self-identify with negative emotions, such as I'm afraid, or I am angry, or I am inferior, or I am superior, because all of those ways of talking to ourselves make it seem like that emotional state is who we are. But we are not an emotional state, because that emotional state is not going to last very long. One of my friends was a hospice nurse, and we used to do presentations together. And she said one time, you know, because certainly in situations when somebody's dying, there is strong emotion going on. She said, "You cannot maintain a strong emotion for more than like 10, 15 minutes, even if you tried to." Yeah. So it goes away, it fades. It may come back later. Yeah, but we can't stay stuck totally 100% in any emotion for a really long time. Yeah. It feels like we are because we fail to notice the moments when we aren't stuck in it. Yeah. Like, oh, I get to eat lunch. That's good. They're serving chocolate and pizza. And we've forgotten totally about, you know, our own trip. Okay, instead, we want to learn to relate to ourselves with acceptance, kindness, and understanding, calmly observing our struggles and difficult emotions as a part of the human experience that unites us with all other beings. So this is the important part. Self-compassion opens us to seeing it's part of the human experience that unites us with all other living beings. Okay. Another approach to self-compassion was developed by Professor Paul Gilbert, an evolutionary psychologist who spent a great deal of time in his career studying shame and its relationship to depression. Boy, I wonder what that makes you feel like, you know, studying shame and depression all day long. Okay. Professor Gilbert developed compassion-focused therapy, CFT, which is based in an evolutionary understanding of human emotions and how they play out within our minds and brains. You've already learned about a few CFT concepts, for example, three types of emotion that we talked about before. You know, do you remember what they were? Feeling threatened. Huh? What I can hear?
Drive.
Yeah. So feeling ambitious or drive, feeling threatened, and feeling safe. Yeah. Okay. Because he's saying, because I, Russell, he said, by the way, this is in entry 12, chapter 12, if you want to refer back. Because I, Russell, take a CFT approach in my own work, and it has influenced my understanding of compassion. Gilbert's model is based on the idea that we, along with every other human being on the planet, have tricky, evolved brains that can influence us to feel powerful and challenging emotions when they are activated by different experiences. He emphasizes the brain part. I emphasize the mind part. But we're friends. These emotions can then organize our minds in ways that can lead to problems for us by shaping the way we think, pay attention, and are motivated to behave in the manner we discussed in entry 12. So go back to, or I mean, in chapter 10. So it's 10. Go back to that. This insight allows us to understand our challenging emotions as simply a part of who we are, not as an indication that there is anything wrong with us. So if I'm going to translate this into Buddhist terms, you know, because he's talking about evolutionary biology, so there's parts of the amygdala and other parts of our brain that trigger us to have a fight or flight response and, you know, parts of the brain that are coordinated with different emotions. A Buddhist approach would be to say things, that emotions that we are habituated with, or distorted concepts we are habituated with, that we always fall back on, that then habitually create certain afflictive states of mind, okay? And to see that as samsaric beings, this is totally normal and natural, okay? So it's kind of a way of accepting ourselves as samsaric beings. So yes, I don't have total control over my mind. Yes, I have afflicted, unrealistic, non-beneficial states of mind. And that doesn't mean something's wrong with me, because I also have the Buddha nature. I also have all sorts of states of mind that are really beneficial and realistic, that can be increased limitlessly, while my samsaric states of mind and my afflictions cannot be increased limitlessly. So eventually, someday, you know, the virtuous aspects of my mind are going to be predominant, and I'm going to become a Buddha. Okay, so clearly there is nothing fundamentally wrong with me. However, I can accept that right now I am a samsaric being, and so I don't expect myself to be a bodhisattva or a Buddha. Okay, I'm going to give you another example of true confession here. Okay, so when I lived in Singapore 25 years ago, and before that too, when I lived in Asia, I was trying really hard to practice. And my teacher is, one of my teachers, incredibly compassionate, and he doesn't sleep. Maybe in the middle of the night, he goes into very deep meditation like this for a few hours, and that's it. He doesn't lie down, so he's not sleeping. So I, in trying to do my work in Singapore and trying to be compassionate when I lived in Asia, I'm trying to really put the Dharma in practice. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I was unconsciously comparing myself to my teacher, saying, I should be like him. He doesn't sleep. I should really, cut down on my sleeping. Because another one of my teachers was saying, that the Buddha said, we should sleep only in the middle of the night. That is 1/6 of the day, so 4 hours. So I gave myself a break, and I was sleeping 5.5 hours, And I thought that was still too much, but I was really going to go, let's not sleep so much. And, so unconsciously, I was constantly comparing myself to my teacher and coming out as a failure. Because sometimes I was just overwhelmed. At one time, two of my students were dying, and I was trying to help both of them, and then teach and do all these other things at the same time. And I was just, and I was saying to myself, if I only had more compassion, I could keep doing all of this. I am so selfish. My limitations are because I am so selfish. I have to stop being so selfish and stomp on this self-cherishing mind because it's bad. And that makes me bad. And I want to be good like my teacher and compassionate and not have to sleep. How well do you think that worked as a strategy to live as a Buddhist practitioner? Yeah? That's not a very workable strategy. You can't hang on to that for long. You can try. I did it for a few years. Yeah? Until I ran out of steam. Yeah. And then I had to really deal with the fact that I was a samsaric being and I wasn't going to be enlightened by next Tuesday. Yeah. And that I have to accept where I'm at and what I'm capable of doing. And in, doing, fulfilling certain responsibilities, it's okay for me to say I have needs in the sense of, it used to be before, because there's a bodhisattva precept that, you should always try and accord with the wishes of others. So I would be doing a teaching tour and people want to take me out for dinner before me giving a talk in the evening. And they take me to a restaurant that's very noisy and we're all screaming at each other trying to talk. And then we go from the restaurant to giving a talk. And I would always accept their dinner invitations because I thought they want to offer. I should be like a bodhisattva and accept their offering, and so on. And then I realized I can't give a good Dharma talk when I'm coming from a noisy restaurant where I can't think straight because of the noise, and I have to scream to talk to other people. I can't give a Dharma talk. Well, I can give a Dharma talk, but not up to how I feel good about it. And if I came here to give Dharma talks, not to go out to dinner with people. So I began having the courage, and it took me enormous courage, to say to people, I need to be quiet before I give a Dharma talk. I cannot go from a social event or from a meeting to giving a Dharma talk if giving the Dharma talk is my major responsibility. And I thought, oh, people are going to be so upset I'm turning down their dinner invitations. And they were totally okay with it. They said, okay, you know, can we give you something to eat by yourself? Yeah, okay, problem fixed. But I felt like I was being so selfish by stating what I needed. And I needed that in order to fulfill my responsibility to them. So it wasn't even something selfish, yeah? But it took me a lot of time to just say, yeah, that's okay. My teacher can't sleep. I need to sleep. Yeah? And I don't have the same level of compassion as my teacher does. And someday, hopefully I will. No, not hopefully. I will. I will. I'll make it happen. Yeah? Okay. So, let me see. Ooh. Can we keep going? Maybe we'll finish the chapter. Okay, self-compassion doesn't mean we fail to hold ourselves responsible for our actions or fail to correct ourselves when we've made mistakes. Our brains may have evolved and our minds may have evolved in such a way that they tend to produce certain emotions in certain situations. For example, fear or anger when we perceive a threat. But from the moment these emotions arise, we have the opportunity to work with them. Over time, through mind training, we can even help ourselves learn to respond differently to such situations. For example, with compassion rather than irritation when someone is hostile to us. Yeah, that's a good mind training, isn't it? Perfection of fortitude. Remember the paths in the forest example from entry 19. Go back to chapter 19. Over time, we can gradually train our brains, our minds, to respond differently, gradually helping ourselves shift from a very threat-driven mode to a more compassionate mode. One part of self-compassion is learning to respond with compassion rather than with irritation or harsh self-attacks when we observe our own mistakes or weaknesses. Compassion-focused therapy makes the distinction between shameful self-attacking and compassionate self-correction. So think about that, yeah? Painful, shameful self-attacking is not the same as compassionate self-correction. Okay? Or they're very different. We need to, you know, subdue one. Embellish the other. In shameful self-attacking, our internal voice is like a harsh and critical judge, focused on disappointments, deficits, and mistakes. Shameful self-attacking relates to the self with anger, frustration, anxiety, and contempt. I'm such an awful person. Nobody is as bad as I am. Nobody is as defective products, as wounded as I am. Something is inherently wrong with me. So that keeps us stuck in the past, obsessing over our failings and feeling threatened. And sometimes our failings weren't really even failings. Sometimes they were just our ability to do the best we can in situations where we cannot control all the conditions. Why should we even think of that as a failing when we can't control all the conditions? In contrast, compassionate self-correction is like a compassionate friend, forward-looking and focused on the desire to improve and be at our best. With compassionate self-correction, we encourage ourselves when we're struggling. This is hard, but I've done difficult things before. Keep going. The focus here is on building our strengths and cultivating abilities like compassion that will help us continually improve ourselves so that we can do better in the future. Yeah. We need to also look at what our idea of doing better is. Where did that idea of doing better come from? Is that somebody else's idea that I've internalized, but I really don't believe or want to be like that? Maybe my parents wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer, but that's not what I want to be. I want to be an artist or an activist or something else. Is that a failure because I haven't met their expectations? No, that's not a failure. If we think we're a failure, it's because we've internalized their values. But those are only our parents' aims for us because that's seeing life through their eyes and what they were and were not able to attain or achieve. When we've got to look at our own talents and our abilities, we've got to look at what is our own passion in life, you know, and not judge ourselves according to other people's standards. Yeah. Certain standards, like being truthful, yes, you know, that's a good standard that everybody has or should have. Some people don't. But, you know, if we're lying, we need to hold ourselves to our own standard of telling the truth. If we're dumping on other people and criticizing them, we need to hold ourselves, you know, accountable for our wish to speak kindly and to abandon harsh speech, okay? So we need to be able to distinguish between what are our own ethical values and what are just worldly aspirations for where we put our energy. Okay, so, or I don't know if I'm, I hope you're getting what I'm saying. Like, okay, my parents want me to be an engineer. I have no ability or interest to be an engineer, okay? I want to be an activist, okay? Or I want to be a Buddhist nun, yeah? Or I want to be a, you know, I want to be a mechanic, because I love mechanics, you know? I don't want to deal with math and numbers all day and be an engineer. That is not a value. That is just something that people, you know, the parents want for us because they love us and they think that will make us happy because that is what makes them happy. That's different than having ethical values, you know, that we want to be kind, we want to be honest, yeah? We don't want to steal things and take what isn't ours. We don't want to lie. We don't want to speak harshly. We want to be able to encourage people. We want to contribute to others' benefit. Those are ethical values. Those are things that we have a standard for inside of ourselves, that we want to really practice, and sometimes we fall short. And when we fall short, then we do purification. It doesn't mean we're hopeless. It means we need to do purification. Yeah. The fact that we choose not to become an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer, that we don't need to do purification for. Okay? That's just a thing of personal preference. Okay? Okay. Then I'll read the reflection and we will exactly be just before 12 o'clock. Okay, so here's the reflection, your homework. Consider your internal voice. When you observe yourself making mistakes or struggling with difficulties, how do you talk to yourself? Do you attack yourself with harsh, shaming criticism, or assuage yourself with understanding, acceptance, warmth, and encouragement? Think of activities that you would like to do but are difficult or that you initially resist doing, perhaps exercising regularly. Yeah. Changing your eating habits or drinking habits or starting a regular meditation practice. Instead of berating yourself for not doing these activities, be kind to yourself, wish yourself well, and with self-respect, encourage yourself to go in a healthy direction. And instead of expecting yourself to exercise for an hour every day, start out with 10 minutes. Yeah, do something that's realistic that you can accomplish, and then gradually you can improve, continue from there.